In part three of our analysis of The Shining, we decode the entire film as Kubrick's ultimate revelation, from Stephen King to America's Dark Soul to Eyes Wide Shut Elite Rituals, Epstein connections, Skull and Bones, The Key Club, occult portals. This is where it all converges. We'll explore the moon landing hoax, MKUltra, Project Monarch, incest theories, blood sacrifice, Crowley's abyss, rituals, and the devouring father archetype. What if The Shining wasn't just a horror story, but a blueprint for the elite's spiritual war? You're listening to Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture, the world's greatest occult symbolism podcast, and we have been unpacking The Shining, and this is the third and final part. Will there be a part four someday? Maybe, if I find more findings. You know, I'm always on the lookout. Now, in part three, we're going to decode the entire film, which we walked through in part one and part two. If you didn't listen to those parts, what are you doing here? Go back to part one, start there. This is where we're going to put it all together. We're going to elaborate and expand upon all these ideas that we've been teasing throughout the film. We're going to talk about Stephen King, America, Illuminati bloodlines, Eyes Wide Shut Elite Parties, Epstein Connections, Skull and Bones, Key Club, Occult Symbolism Portals, Cut Up Method, the Labyrinths, MKUltra, Nazis, NASA, the Fake Moon Landing, Project Monarch, a pedo incest theory, Jack's Shadow from Carl Jung, blood sacrifices to the gods, the Kabbalistic meaning of God, the devouring father theory, the Crowley's rituals, and the blood needed to cross the abyss. There's so much to unpack. We got to get right into it. What was this film all about? We're going to start light, and we're going to get heavier as we go. Stick with me, because by the end, you're going to say, holy crap, Isaac, there was so much going on in that film. I'm going to have to rewatch it. Yes, that's what we do. That's what we do. The lightest and most obvious, there's some kind of beef between Kubrick and Stephen King, right? There's some drama there. You saw it throughout the film. You had the red Volkswagen Bug from the novel getting destroyed. Wendy's hair in the book is golden. In the movie, it couldn't be any further from it. It's like solid black. We're not even in the same hotel. We're at the Timberline Lodge for the exterior shots instead of the Stanley Hotel. Room 237 was a replacement for room 217. Jay Widener, the great, the OG, he said that there is no room 217 at the Timberline. So that whole story about the Timberline saying, hey, Stanley Kubrick, don't you make a big scary story about one of our rooms. People aren't going to want to stay there. Apparently, it's not true. Dick Halloran takes two different roles in this story. In the book, he saves Wendy and Danny. In the movie, he's just axe fodder for Jack Torrance. And Stephen King obviously hated this whole movie. He remade the whole thing for a TV series. And of course it wasn't as good as Kubrick. Of course it wasn't. I don't know what he was thinking. And I like Stephen King. You know, no shade to Stephen King. But if I got to pick one, I'm taking Kubrick. Now, I don't know. I shouldn't even say that. I really enjoy Stephen King's books, you know? The Stand. I heard they're remaking The Stand again. That's great. I like The Stand and It and Misery and Salem's Lot. Oh, boy. I don't know if I could pick. I can't pick between Stephen King and Kubrick. Next topic and theme of The Shining, though. We're sticking with The Shining. America. All right? As you recall, throughout the film, we saw the outfits being worn by our characters, red, white, and blue, almost every scene. U.S. flags everywhere, in the dispatch offices at K2, K12, the game room where Danny was playing and he saw the Grady twins, Stuart Allman's office loaded down with propaganda, eagles and flags, and he looked like JFK. Then you've, of course, got the fake moon landing, right? That whole theory. A theory presented by Jay Widener in the Kubrick's Odyssey series with, of course, you already know the story. The allegation is that Kubrick was hired basically by NASA, possibly the Operation Paperclip Nazis even, America, possibly through contacts with JFK as is described in, what's his name? We talked about his book, The Minotaur, by Recluse. But anyways, the idea is that Kubrick allegedly filmed a fake moon landing. this 1969 Apollo 11 moon landing that we all saw on the TV, fake news. And you already know I think the whole moon landing is fake. In fact, I'm going to put a link in the show notes for you guys. Fake moon landing link. Because I did a whole show about this. It's one of the only theories I kind of stand on business about. That, and I don't think the Trump assassination attempt was real. I think that was staged firmly. Just as fake as the moon landing, I think. Now, the question is, was Kubrick paid to do this as a psyop? I believe it could be. I have no proof. I don't know if Kubrick was involved. I do think the Apollo moon landing was a psyop. Because why wouldn't it be, right? Here in America, we're spoon-fed propaganda about how terrible communism is and how great capitalism is. And the American empire must exist in every country around the world. So why wouldn't they do that to us, right? They've taken out communist leaders in other countries. And look, I love America. I think this is a great country, you know? I'm just saying, we get lied to sometimes. Facts, right? Kubrick left America in 1965. This is before 2001 A Space Odyssey. This is before the moon landing. He left and he never returned, not one time. And 3 years later, he drops 2001. A year after that, Apollo 11 happened. And the theory is that he confessed to all of this in The Shining in 1980. The evidence includes Danny's sweater, which literally shows the Apollo 11 rocket. What do you call it? Shuttle? Space shuttle? The carpet, which looked like the landing pad at Cape Canaveral. Room 237 being a reference to 237,000 miles from the Earth to the Moon, and the keychain that said room number, which Jay Widener interprets as, if you rearrange the letters, as moon room. And the distance to the Moon, this is one of controversy. From what I understand from the nerds, they say that the Moon is a satellite of the Earth on an elliptical orbit, which means the distance from the Earth to the Moon varies from as close as 225,000 miles to as far as 252,000 miles. So 237 is dang near in the middle. It's dang near the average of those two. I mean, we're off by about 1,000, to be fair. But the point remains is that Jay Widener's got a pretty solid theory with the fake moon landing deal. There's a video of Kubrick allegedly confessing to it. This guy looks like Kubrick. This is before the age of AI. I've read that that's not real. I don't know, obviously. I wasn't there. I think Vivian Kubrick, his daughter, has publicly denounced this theory. Said it was impossible. She was with Kubrick all those years, and hey. But it all points to one theory that is something we all can believe in. The elites control us, and they control us through magic, through the illusion and entertainment. Stuart Almond tells Jack and Wendy, only the finest people go to the Overlook. And that's the elites. And to back that up in the book, it spells it out. It says it's bloodlines like the Rockefellers, the Astors, and the DuPonts. These are the Illuminati bloodlines. As we discussed in part, I think, one. Then we have the ladder symbolism referring to the Freemasons. Then we have the Native American idea, how the Overlook was built on Indian burial grounds. And then these references to keeping America clean, as well as the Calumet baking powder, which shows the Native American on it. And recall that the book goes into detail on the bear man who's given the Hummer for the summer, right? The dog man. And he is revealed to be a sex slave for the owner of the Overlook, Horace Derwent. And Horace Derwent used to throw these depraved parties, which were very similar to what you hear about Epstein and Diddy, blackmail type stuff operations, which is where we connect into a deeper version of this hot take on this elite theory, right? And this is where we get into the ideas of Eyes Wide Shut, the elites, and how to access hidden realms. Because in the book version, the details given to us are about the owner of the Overlook, Horace Derwent. And when you read the book, you find out that Jack Torrance, while he's at the Overlook, he goes into the basement and he finds these scrapbooks. And the scrapbooks relay the history of who owned the hotel and what they did. There was a party on August 29th, 1945, that said it had unmasking and dancing at midnight. Unmasking, by default, means they were wearing masks. This was a masked ball, just like Kubrick would show us in Eyes Wide Shut. He was very intrigued by this whole idea because he probably attended a party or heard of elites attending parties just like this. And then towards the end of the book, there's these constant references of Jack hearing the voices of Horace yelling, unmask, unmask, because at midnight they were supposed to pull their mask off. Again, a reference you can find in Eyes Wide Shut. Because as you know the history, Stanley Kubrick met his wife at a masked ball. That's right. And in Eyes Wide Shut, Red Cloak instructs Tommy Salami, Dr. Harford, to remove his mask. It's the only protection he has of this anonymity in this party of elites, the finest people that Stuart Allman talks to Jack and Wendy about. And we know Eyes Wide Shut is about the Illuminati because at the end, Ziegler gives Dr. Harford a final warning about who he's messing with, right? Furthermore, if you followed my 6-part series on Eyes Wide Shut, you know I dedicated an entire episode to the Edgar Allan Poe story, The Mask of Red Death. Now, The Mask of Red Death was also very important to Stanley Kubrick and Stephen King. I'm going to read to you from The Shining, the novel. Dinner at 8, unmasking at midnight. He could almost see them in the dining room, the richest men in America and their women. Another, you know, Illuminati confirm. Make no mistake about it. He's talking about the elites. Tuxedos and glimmering starched shirts, evening gals, the band playing, gleaming high-heeled pumps, the clink of glasses, the jocund pop of champagne corks. The war was over, or almost over. The future lay ahead, clean and shining. America was the colossus of the world, and at last she knew it and accepted it. And later at midnight, Derwent himself crying, "Unmask! Unmask!" The mask coming off, and the Red Death held sway over all. He frowned. What left field had that come out of? That was Poe, the great American hack. And surely the Overlook, the shining, glowing Overlook on the invitation he held in his hands, was the furthest cry from Edgar Allan Poe imaginable. So you can see that that story was important to Stephen King. And what's interesting is that Stephen King talks about the owner of the Overlook having all these connections to the military-industrial complex, various businesses involved with bootlegging, prostitution, and gambling. Prostitution, of course, important here. Diddy Epstein. He also owned Top Mark Studios, which was a Hollywood film studio. What do you know? And he put a man named Henry Finkel in charge of it. Henry is described as a raging sex maniac in the book. And coincidentally, he also talks about a child star that died prematurely for Top Mark Studios. Take a listen to this. Probably Derwent's most famous investment was the purchase of the foundering Top Mark's. I think there's a misprint in this. I read this on Kindle and I copied and pasted it. I think it means floundering. Did I just find a mistake? Okay, probably Derwent's most famous investment was the purchase of the floundering Top Mark Studios, which had not had a hit since their child star, Little Marjorie Morris, had died of a heroin overdose in 1934. She was 14. Little Marjorie, who had specialized in sweet 7-year-olds who saved marriages and the lives of dogs unjustly accused of killing chickens, had been given the biggest Hollywood funeral in history by Top Mark. The official story was that Little Marjorie had contracted a wasting disease while entertaining at a New York orphanage. Some cynics suggested the studio had laid out all that long green because it knew it was burying itself. And you know that there's possibilities that this was part of the Hollywood system, because we know the story of Drew Barrymore, who was hooked up to drugs and going to parties when she was a child in Hollywood. And Horace Derwent, who was behind all of these various nefarious business operations, was described as the world's richest men and the friends of royalty. Take a listen to this. It says, "The ward made him rich and he was still rich. Living in Chicago, seldom seen except for Derwent Enterprises board meetings, which he ran with an iron hand. It was rumored that he owned United Airlines Las Vegas, where he was known to have controlling interest in 4 hotel casinos and some involvement in at least 6 others, Los Angeles, and the USA itself. Reputed to be a friend of royalty, presidents, and the underworld kingpins, it was supposed by many that he was the richest man in the world." Make no mistake about it, we're talking about the elites. We're talking about Elon Musk and Epstein and all these folks. Horace Derwent would sell the Overlook in 1961. It became a writing school with a bunch of alcoholics, apparently, which was ironic since Jack is a writing alcoholic at the Overlook. It says that in 1961, 4 writers, 2 of them Pulitzer Prize winners, had leased the Overlook and reopened it as a writer's school that had lasted 1 year. One of the students had gotten drunk in his third floor room, crashed out the window, fell to his death. The paper hinted it might have been suicide. Also, in the story, Jack reads all this stuff and he decides he's going to write a book about the Overlook and its history. And he even calls Stuart Allman to tell him, like, "Hey, I'm going to write a book about all this." And Stuart starts tripping hard, right? But here's where it gets real interesting. After the writing school, it gets bought by some Vegas mobster types and they call it the Key Club. Says Robert Leffing, spokesman for a group of investors going under the name of High Country Investments, announced in Vegas that High Country has negotiated a deal for the famous Overlook, a resort located high in the Rockies. Leffing declined to mention the names of specific investors, but said the hotel would be turned into an executive key club. He said the group he represents hopes to sell memberships to high echelon executives in American and foreign companies. And of course, it's a bunch of mobsters and criminals, but it's curious they chose the name Key Club because keys are the most occulted symbol of all, says James Shelby Downard. He would know. They symbolize access into the back rooms, right? You heard, what's his name? Comedian Kevin Hart talked about how in Hollywood, there's like a room within the room. He says, you think you're in the room, and then there's a little door, and there's another room within the room, right? Well, the key is the symbol of accessing that inner chamber of knowledge. Through indoctrination or initiation, it's accessing new realms, crossing dimensions, like the Keys of Solomon or the Lost Keys of Freemasonry, or even Bluebeard's Key, which we talked about Bluebeard in part 2. We talked about room 237. Because keys symbolize the power to the elites. They have the authority and control over who can enter and who can access this inner sanctum, this inner gnosis. It's giving the mysteries to only those who deserve it, basically. Which takes us into the idea of occult symbolism and portals in this film. Because the story of The Shining came from Stephen King originally. Remember, he stayed at the Stanley and had all these nightmares and visions. He stayed there October 30th, over Samhain. But Kubrick would take the story, and he would further alter it. And it's alleged that he was using surrealist techniques, like the cut-up method from William S. Burroughs, actually created in the 50s by Brian Geisen, who was... What he would do is he would cut up newspapers on his paint table to sort of like paint. And he noticed that sometimes these words would assemble themselves into certain messages. And then William S. Burroughs would apply this sort of technique into his writings, as did David Bowie, Genesis P. Ulrich, and so on. You could even argue that the Ghost Adventures use a similar idea with one of their voice box machines. It scans frequencies and kind of pulls out chops up words. And in this surrealist technique, it's a way of pulling messages or information from a hidden realm, from the shadows, and breaking free from the restrictive forces of Saturn, right? Sort of like automatic writing in a way, and which David Lynch's daughter, Jennifer Lynch, would use some forms of automatic writing to write The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer. Because all these, you know, Stephen King, David Lynch, Stanley Kubrick, all three of these prolific creators had a way of making contact with unseen realms. But the cut-up method would provide a way of a sort of mini time travel effect, because it disrupts this linear process of time and jumbles up the words within it. And Burroughs would put this into stories when scenes would jump between the future, the past, and the present. And it reprograms the mind to stop projecting and linearly trying to predict what the next line or idea is going to be, which uses your conscious ego, and it tunes into what's currently being said and allows the unconscious to work, is how the theory goes. And Kubrick and Lynch are very good at this. They create these dreamlike films done partially by playing with the linear time stuff, right? Like Twin Peaks, that's a big component of it, is, you know, what year is this kind of thing. And Jack Torrance in The Shining, we're told, has always been the caretaker. How is that even possible? Well, when you throw the timelines out the window of the years in linear time, maybe, right? Because Jack's in the photo from 1921 at the end of the movie. How's that even possible? The point is allowed to make contact of the unconscious mind to engage with the art that they are creating. And Lynch's films are very good at engaging the subconscious mind and really mashing up timelines, you know? Especially when it comes to like The Red Room and Twin Peaks. Time seems to be a little slippery. Okay. They speak in reverse. That's what, like a literal cutting up of language. That's a literal cut up method. But in The Shining, there's a scene in the book. Jack and Wendy, they make love. And again, Kubrick didn't put this into the film for a reason. He wanted Jack to be just basically a monster from the get-go. But in the book, it's Stephen King made him more relatable, made him kind of like a, you know, just a normal dude who had some struggles. And you know there was a reason Kubrick didn't put that in there, you know, because Kubrick was not afraid of putting some sex on there. He was a big old perv. He was talking about making a big high-budget porno at one time. But in the scene in the book, they're discussing what's going on with Danny, how Danny's having these visions, and Jack explains to Wendy how symbolism works in a very Jungian language. Let's take a read here. He gave her a brief squeeze. We know he goes into, well, trances, for want of a better word, from time to time. We know that when he's in them, he sometimes sees things he doesn't understand. If precognitive trances are possible, they're probably functions of the subconscious mind. Freud said that the subconscious never speaks to us in literal language, only in symbols. If you dream about being in a bakery where no one speaks English, you may be worried about your ability to support your family. Or maybe just that no one understands you. I've read that the falling dream is a standard outlet for the feelings of insecurity. Games, little games. Conscious on one side of the net, subconscious on the other. Serving some cockamamie image back and forth. Same with mental illness, with hunches, all of that. Why should precognition be any different? Maybe Danny really did see blood all over the walls of the presidential suite. To a kid his age, the image of blood and the concept of death are nearly interchangeable. To kids, the image is always more accessible than the concept anyway. William Carlos Williams knew that. He was a pediatrician. When we grow up, concepts gradually get easier and we leave the images to the poets. Interesting analysis here. Interesting idea, talking about the images and the concepts being related through symbolism, and how when we get older, the concepts become easier, but the images become harder. And this is one of the major components of occultism. When you look at Kenneth Grant's work that we did a show on, Outside the Circles of Time, I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes. That was a good, you can't miss that one. Kenneth Grant, Outside. We just did that not too long ago. That was a really good example of how they talk about the artist being able to perceive disruptions and how important it was to have artists make contact with these hidden realms, the shadow side of the Kabbalistic tree of life and so on. And what do we get in the movie? We get Danny talking to Tony, oftentimes through a mirror being a classic portal, right? We did a two-part series on portals. Also very important in revealing Red Rum as murder. So in a way, Kubrick was showing us reverse speech in the written form, you know? Because, you know, Kubrick was into David Lynch. We talked about this already. The part one, we talked about how he was screening Eraserhead for everybody. And then we also have the labyrinth being a component of the story, because it's going to be about Jack confronting his shadow inside of it as the Minotaur, but the shadow wins. We're going to come back to that here in a bit. He's trying to cross the abyss to become a master of the temple, in terms of Crowley and Jack Parsons' talk. But he's got too much ego, and he dies in the maze. And it's all about the idea of dream spaces, accessing other realms. That's why Jack can see Wendy and Danny inside the labyrinth diorama inside the hotel, and it makes no sense. As does the layout of the hotel. It makes no sense. It's supposed to be that way. In the book, there is no labyrinth, and there's no discussion about how the rooms don't line up and there's floors that don't exist. And it's strange because in the book, there's no labyrinth, but there's hedge monsters. And there's a part where Danny sees one of the hedge rabbits covered in snow and views it as the white rabbit. Classic tale of initiation, Alice in Wonderland. And then you got Saturn, which is a huge component in the symbolism of this story. Because that's the main theme, is this confusion of time and the construct of time. Jack's always been the caretaker. How? How did he know who Delbert Grady was when he had never seen him before? How does that tie into some of these ideas of the cut-up method? Well, it's about sort of chopping up time and not falling in line with the rules of the planetary force of Saturn. And we know the hotel and its pagan pantheon of denizens are bloodthirsty. They want Jack to sacrifice his own son to the hotel. And this is an element of Saturn worship, okay? They're very much into the human sacrifice, as you can read about in The Cult of the Black Cube by Arthur Morrows. I plan on doing a book club on that someday. Interesting read. And the Saturnian element is the devouring father mythology, which is a reference to Cronos eating his own children. And the technical mythology is actually that Saturn or Cronos would consume his children whole. He would swallow them like a pill, not necessarily cannibalism, but swallows them like a pill, and they would later come back and join a war against Saturn, where he would eventually be enchained and sent to the underworld to rule, which is symbolized as the black cube. But Saturn is known for the cannibalization of children or the cannibalization of other gods in the way of consuming them to take their essence, which is very much tied into the ideas of Shunamitism, which is what Kubrick was referring to in Eyes Wide Shut. I'm going to put a link to the Eyes Wide Shut index, because in case some of you guys haven't listened to those are going to be important, because you're probably like, what are you talking about, Shunamitism? Well, you're going to have to listen to it, because I dug deep into the film, the making of the film. I bought the original book that Kubrick bought that talks about Shunamitism. And it's this idea that ties into the realm of adrenochrome and child abuse and all those things. That's what it's all about. And that's why maybe Danny was talking about the Donner Party cannibalism in the car ride to the Overlook at the beginning of the film. But in The Cult of the Black Cube by Arthur Moros, he describes the various forms of Saturnine worship, and here's some elements we need to look at. He goes through a few different forms of Saturn worship, and this one is about Islamic Saturn worship, and he goes through some rituals that show how it's important to look at the concept of time. He says, these suggest a deity that is seen to be timeless or to have power over the course of time. It is good to indicate here that these are not terms that are used of the other six planetary gods. And since clearly those gods are quite ancient, we understand that Saturn is ancient in a truly cosmic sense. And the ideas presented are that Saturn is the ruler over other planetary bodies. It's also a dark force. For instance, they called Saturn Zuhal, and Zuhal was attracted to spilled blood. They would sacrifice bats to this god, and it's supposedly like black animals, but the bats hold a significance in Arab culture. It goes deep into it, which makes me think about Ozzy Osbourne biting the head off that black bat. Also makes me think of, 40-Year-Old Virgin? My guy says, I cannot put my knife away until it has spilt blood. Off topic. But the ruling of Saturnine includes locations such as the Black Mountains, graveyards, and basements. That's how it's described in Cult of the Black Cube. All of which are part of the Overlook. It's on a mountain. It's on a Native American burial ground. And the furnace is in the basement. The furnace is part of the... It's more important in the novel than the movie. But it's all lining up to Saturn worship. It also says that the scents of Saturn, the smells, are like wisteria and licorice, which connects us into the realm of Twin Peaks yet again, because there's this whole idea about wisteria being a secret Twin Peaks project, maybe. I discovered the wisteria at the end of season one inside of One-Eyed Jax as wisteria. Saturn is also the god of cold and icy. All right. In going beyond the Picatrix, we note that its compiler repeats the earlier words of Ibn Washia, that Saturn is cold. At the risk of restating what that transmission has already explained so clearly, we should alert the reader once more to the important fact that Zuhal is understood in this particular Islamic tradition as a cold, harsh, distant power. Zuhal is the icy, harsh power that embodies restraint, which can come from sickness, weakness, age, imprisonment, isolation, and even death. He is the deity that symbolizes restraint, and his influence corrupts and distorts the power of the other planets, to the point that the Picatrix tradition warns against attempting planetary magic if Saturn is adversely placed or retrograde, as the tradition holds that Saturn's restraining power will limit or distort an otherwise successful magical working. Note how Jack Torrance dies in the film. Dies from exposure to the ice and the cold inside of the labyrinth. Huh? In the book, of course, he dies because the furnace blows up. And you can also read in the book about the Indian Saturn god of mythology called Sani. And it's described as a belief that Sani can introduce death to a person, which is a good thing in their view, because they believe in Dharma, which suggests that it's better to die and be reincarnated rather than continuing to accrue bad karma, which would have a more negative rebirth. So in a way, Jack is stacking up his bad karma, butchering people. So Saturn kills him in the icy cold labyrinth, which is a good thing, because now it can be reborn yet again as the caretaker to start over. Now we've got one of the bigger theories, MK Ultra Mind Control. I recall that Kubrick is no newbie to this territory. He did a little film called A Clockwork Orange, a movie literally about government mind control and behavioral modification. If you checked out the links to part one, we talked about how important Catcher in the Rye is to this story. It's in the movie. You see Wendy reading the book and how it has ties to MK Ultra intelligence stuff through J.D. Salinger. Massive rabbit hole of possible intelligence agencies doing mind control operations. You also see the Kool-Aid showing up twice at Wendy's apartment and also in the pantry, which we tied into the ideas of cults. And then you got Nazis, which is where MK Ultra came from. Recall that Kubrick's wife, Christiane, I don't know how you say her name, Christiane, her uncle was Viet Harlan, the Nazi propaganda director. So Kubrick may have really been intrigued by these occult ideas. And the story, Stephen King's original story, you know, has the Volkswagen, which the Volkswagen is the people's choice car of Germany. And there's also the Adler typewriter in Kubrick's version, not the Underwood. It's the Adler, which is a German typewriter that means eagle, which we tied into all the American symbolism back in part one or two. I don't remember. And recall the history of MK Ultra was to bring Nazi scientists over in Operation Paperclip. A lot of it was done with NASA or JPL for rocket science, like Wernher von Braun, which could tie us into that the reason we saw the rocket launching on the fridge in part one. Because those Nazis, they weren't just good at rocket science and occultism. They were doing mind control experimentation. And this is all part of the Apollo 11 fake moon landing. You know? Which I already went on and on about all this. Because, you know, Kubrick filmed 2001 before... right before America saw the supposed footage of Americans landing on the moon in 69. The theory also includes the idea that he got this very rare NASA Zeiss lens. Apparently, he used three of the only 10 ever created. If it's one of the fastest lenses ever, that's how he got the candlelight scenes in Barry Lyndon. And Jay Widener also asserts that Kubrick was using front-end screen projection techniques in 2001, which you see on the fake moon landing. And if you add in all the strange connections that Jay had found, it seems maybe there's something to that, basically, right? And it could be... I don't think that's important. I don't want to go down this too far off path. But the idea of MK Ultra includes this idea of unlocking supernatural powers, the CDs. Danny's ability to shine, basically. And it's theorized that this is accomplished through traumatic sexual abuse. And when someone is abused, they are forced to disassociate from their body and create alter egos sometimes. That's why Danny has this alter named Tony. Could have been put in place there through some kind of traumatic abuse. Remember he said Tony lives in his mouth. It's pretty dark. And the idea is that Danny unlocks these supernatural powers of divination into the future and the ability to detect this unified field, this anima mundi, which fits into a lot of the MK Ultra type programs, which or the remote viewing stuff like Project Stargate, which we interviewed Ryder Lee about. And Danny says it's like he goes to sleep and Tony shows him things. It's because he's going over the rainbow. He's disassociating, which is a common theme we see in Eyes Wide Shut, right? With the over the rainbow costume store. So maybe the overlook is another reference of going over the rainbow. And it's arguable that Jack, his own father, could have been doing this abuse to Danny. Remember we had that whole creepy scene where Jack is sitting with Danny on his lap. Jack was reading the Playgirl magazine with the article about incest. We see Danny lying on the giant pedo bear. And then later you see the bear man giving a Hummer for the summer to the elites. You know. And in the book, Danny is the one that sees the dog man. It's not a bear. It's a dog in the book. And the dog man says something very creepy to Danny. He says to Danny, "Not by the hair of my chinny chin chin." His small red eyes were fixed attentively on Danny's face. He continued to grin. "I'm going to eat you up, little boy, and I think I'll start with your plump little cock." Yeah, that's in the book. Yeah. And, you know, we've compared Lynch and Kubrick multiple times. So when we look at this film through that lens of, okay, was Danny being abused from his own family incestually? I mean, could tie into the world of Twin Peaks. And then you've also got the Project Monarch references with the Grady twins, because, you know, because the twins are not in the book. They're just sisters. But in Kubrick's version, they're twins, and they show up for the first time by a poster that says Monarch. Monarch allegedly being a program to research bloodlines and how psychic abilities could be passed genetically, which, you know, Jack has the ability maybe. That's why he drinks so much and he hands it to Danny. We find that out in Dr. Sleep that Jack was an alcoholic, or I'm sorry, that Jack had shining abilities too, I believe. In the book, it says something real concerning to add to this theory. I'm going to read you this passage, and you're going to hear Jack Torrance sympathizing with a child molester. Listen to this. Jack is a writer and he writes plays, and he's talking about his own characters that he's written about. Ordinarily, he liked all of his characters, the good and the bad. He was glad he did. It allowed him to see all of their sides and understand their motivations more clearly. His favorite story, sold to a small southern Maine magazine called Contraband for copies, has been a piece called "The Monkey Is Here," Paul DeLong. It had been about a child molester about to commit suicide in his furnished room. The child molester's name had been Paul DeLong, Monkey to his friends. Jack had liked Monkey very much. He sympathized with Monkey's bizarre needs, knowing that Monkey was not the only one to blame for the 3 rape murders in his past. There had been bad parents, the father a beater as his own father had been, the mother a limp and silent dish rag as his mother had been, a homosexual experience in grammar school, public humiliation, worse experiences in high school and college. He had been arrested and sent to an institution after exposing himself to a pair of little girls getting off a school bus. Worst of all, he had been dismissed from the institution, let back out onto the streets, because the man in charge had decided he was all right. Jack could sympathize with Grimmer's problem. He could sympathize with the parents of the murder victims, with the murdered children themselves, of course, and with Monkey DeLong. Let the reader lay blame. In those days, he hadn't wanted to judge. The cloak of the moralist sat badly on his shoulders. So there you go. Illuminati confirmed Jack. He's this is a concept that we've talked about many times in the past on Breaking Social Norms more than this show. This idea of how do you stop this from happening? We all agree this is a terrible thing. Probably could be the worst thing, right? And how do you stop this kind of behavior? And where do you assign blame? Because a lot of times people that do this kind of stuff were victims of it when they were kids, you know? And it's not to take blame away from them, but it's also like, well, how far back do we go at assigning blame? And it's interesting that Kubrick would choose Jack Nicholson to play this character after reading the book. You know, he was in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He was friends with Polanski. He had his own strange family history that we talked about in part one. And we can go a little bit into Dr. Sleep. I did a whole show about this, I believe, back, 2019, I think. And the story is about Danny as an adult battling his addictions to alcohol. And he works in a hospice. And he uses his psychic abilities of the shine to assist people as they die to pass. That's why they call him Dr. Sleep. And it's interesting because in that Playgirl magazine, the article is about parents sleeping with their children. I don't know, just a little play on words, I guess. But anyway, in Dr. Sleep, there's lots of talk about magic. Like his cat is named Azrael, which is the name of the angel of death. His niece is Abra Stone, which is a play on the word abracadabra, which is the Gnostic god. And she can shine with Danny. They communicate telepathically again. Then you've got this vampire cult called the True Knot. And they feed off of steam. All right. And the steam is the psychic ability of people like Danny with their shining. And if they find that if they take these kids with these abilities and they scare them, like they threaten to like stab them with a knife while they hold them down in the book, they can get more fear and the more steam out of these kids. It's very adrenochrome-ish. And it all ties into these ideas like we talked about with Shunamatism and harvesting energy from young virgins and all this crazy stuff, right? And I think Kubrick might have been showing us how the elites ritualistically use these concepts, blood sacrifice, abuse, and all these things. And here's just another example with Jack Torrance and his character. Jack Shadow. I am Jack's violent shadow. Reference to Fight Club, which will be our next big film analysis, thanks to all the Patreon and VIP section voters. It's kind of funny because I'm reading Fight Club right now, and like that's why that's fresh in my mind, because that's what they say is anyway, you get it. If you've seen Fight Club, you get the joke. Anyways, the shadow is a reference to the theories of Carl Jung, which is where all this idea of symbolism comes from. And he believed that the shadow is this repressed, unconscious part of our personality that is where we hide all of our little nasty bits, our weaknesses, our fears, our desires, all this stuff. And we repress it because it's dangerous. But in the occult and a lot of New Age thought, there's this idea that we should embrace it. We should do shadow work to approach the shadow and become whole and evolve, which is what Carl Jung was saying. He said, I'd rather be whole than good, because there's some kind of power to evolve that way. And my thought is that Jack Torrance's time in the hotel is about descent into madness and murder. The house facilitates the shadow taking over Jack Torrance. And it throws all these entities at him. We got Lloyd and Grady, who are egging him on to murder his family, basically. And those could just be archetypes from Jack's own subconscious. And he navigates his own mind, symbolized by the labyrinth, going deeper inwards towards the shadow at the core where the Minotaur is. He fails to integrate the shadow. It takes over and destroys him. And this was the warnings that Aleister Crowley and Jack Parsons had for this process. And the Overlook is the abyss, and it represents the space between the ego and the conscious mind versus the shadow and the unconscious mind that one must cross over to find their true divine self and become whole. And Jack couldn't let go of his ego. He ends up letting the shadow take over before he can cross. He fails and goes mad, as the exact warnings are for this type of operation from Aleister Crowley. Furthermore, in the book, you hear why Danny has these powers of the shining. He was born with a call, which is why he has this, you know, shining ability. And the call is a superstition. And the call is actually an amniotic sac that is attached to a baby's head at birth, kind of like a veil, and it happens 1 in 80,000 births, and it's an omen that they believe gives psychic abilities to divinate the future, visions, seeing between two worlds. There's another Twin Peaks, chance out between two worlds. But Danny, he's able to do this. He's able to live in both worlds, the conscious and the unconscious, opposing polarities, if you will, symbolized by the Baphomet stance of Jack Torrance at the end of the film. Carl Jung would say that integrating these two is something you can do through individuation, but Danny was born integrated. Okay, he was born with it. And to add more to the magic idea of this, in the book, there's this constant drama of these wasps at the hotel that Jack's trying to get rid of, and Danny gets stung by one after Jack fails to kill them all, and it makes him feel bad. And they talk about bees and wasps and the differences between the two. And the point is, I believe that bees reference magic. That's a, it's a symbol for magic, right? And it also could be part of why Jack is shown with the arms of the Baphomet, is the integration of the shadow. But the magic idea is sort of owned by Danny, which he has integrated the shadow already. And we know that the hotel is alive from, you know, how the story goes. But what if it's a giant mind? Jack is a form of the unconscious shadow. Danny is the conscious. And it's trying to individuate and bring these two together, but it keeps failing, and the shadow, which is Jack, keeps winning. That's just an idea. I don't know. But it keeps projecting shadows onto the caretakers. Now, let's go to the final theory. Let's wrap this up. This is kind of a longer one, though. It's the big concept is blood sacrifices to the gods, all right? Jack makes a Faustian bargain with the bartender, Lloyd. He says he'd give his soul for a drink, but now he owes the hotel some blood, the blood of his firstborn son. We also know that he appears to be stuck in this space-time of the hotel overlook, and Grady tells him he's always been the caretaker. And there's this whole dialogue of him telling Wendy about how he's got these obligations that she'll never understand. And we're assuming it's the obligation of watching the Overlook as the caretaker. But what if it's not that? What if it's the Faustian bargain? Jay Widener thinks that maybe this is how Kubrick felt. He had a bargain or a pact with NASA for the fake moon landing, and now he's got to fulfill the contract. But in the book, you hear more about how the house wants Danny and Jack the house wants Jack to kill Danny under the idea that Jack will be promoted if he does a good job and become the manager. And during the party scene, when Jack sees Horace Derwent tormenting the dog man, Roger, Jack is talking to Grady, who is saying, like, hey, if you blood sacrifice your son, we're going to make you the manager. All right. So there's part of the Faustian pact. I'm going to read you from the book. A dedicated man, Grady said warmly. Perhaps I put it badly, sir. Let us say that your future here is contingent upon how you decide to deal with your son's waywardness. I make my own decisions, Jack whispered. But you must deal with him. I will. Firmly, I will. A man who cannot control his own family holds very little interest in our manager. A man who cannot guide the courses of his own wife and son can hardly be expected to guide himself, let alone assume a position of responsibility in an operation of this magnitude. I said I'll handle him, Jack shouted, suddenly enraged. Tuxedo Junction had just concluded and a new tune hadn't begun. His shout fell perfectly into the gap and the conversation suddenly ceased behind him. His skin suddenly felt hot all over. He began fixedly positive that everyone was staring at him. They had finished with Roger and would now commence with him. Roll over, sit up, play dead. If you play the game with us, we'll play the game with you. Position of responsibility. They wanted him to sacrifice his son. So it's very crystal clear in the book. That's what this is about. The hotel wants Jack to murder and blood sacrifice his son. They want him to play the role of Roger the Dog Man, who, as we talked about in part two, is begging for this attention from Horace Derwent, the wealth of the elites. And he has to play this game. And he does. And in the book scene, Grady takes Jack to a clockwork piece that hits midnight. And in the piece, it's a guy smashing his son's head in with a hammer. Because in the book, it's not an axe, it's a hammer, right? It's a croquet hammer. And this is a scene where they also compare the story to the Mask of the Red Death. Now, we talked about 42 a bunch, right? 2 times 3 times 7 equals 42. They're watching the Summer of 42. Wendy swings the bat 42 times. Danny says Red Rum 42 times. Danny's wearing a 42 on his shirt. Well, what does it mean? In Kabbalah, it means God. And I got this from a book called Meditation in Kabbalah from Aryeh Kaplan. And the concept is laid out as an instructional for meditation prep by pronouncing certain Hebrew vowels that add up to 42. I'm going to read you from the book. All the vowels, therefore, point to the fact that they are in God's hand. YHVH equals 42. I think it's pronounced Yahweh. This is alluded to in the verse, "Let us fall in God's hand, for his mercies are great, but let me not fall into the hand of man." Their mystery is God equals 42. My only one equals 42. In them equals 42. My heart equals 42. Will be worthy equals 42. And this mystery, enough equals 42. And if heaven forbid, when you pronounce these two verses, you still do not receive the divine influx, speech, or visible vision of a man, start again, begin the third verse. So the point is to perform this sort of incantation to God, and the initiate would receive this divine influx, a vision of a man, a prophetic vision. All right, what does that sound like? It sounds like The Shining, a prophetic vision, by calling upon God, which is 42. Which could explain why you see 42 throughout the entire film over and over and over. It's a Kabbalistic initiation of having contact with God. Or maybe it's meant to create an actual psychic ability in the viewer in a crazy way, right? Now, the final shot of the film, we see Jack in the Baphomet stance, as above, so below. He's the magician in this film, creating this hellscape and making Faustian bargains. He attempts to cross the abyss, but he fails. He's attempting the ultimate sacrifice, like Isaac slaying his son, the ultimate offering to these gods. Only there's no angel to stop Jack here to save Danny. Dick Torrance, I guess. Or Dick Halloran, excuse me. And again, we talked about the archetype of the devouring father, like we see in a variety of shows and stuff. And Carl Jung talked about it as one of the archetypes, like the symbols we talked about with Jack telling Wendy about Freud. And the devouring father is like the shadow in the story of Kronos. And the hotel is a strange mix-up of space and time because we don't know what year it is, right? And there's this layout of rooms and floors that don't make sense, and it's this weird scramble. So, and then there's, let me see here. So, the idea is that Jack needs to perform a sacrifice in a particular ritualistic manner. And if you read Magic in Theory and Practice by Crowley, he says this. He talks about blood sacrifice. He says, the animal should be therefore killed within the circle or the triangle, as the case may be, so that its energy cannot escape. An animal should be selected whose nature accords with that of the ceremony. Thus, by sacrificing a female lamb, one would not obtain any appreciate quantity of the fierce energy useful to a magician who was invoking Mars. In such a case, a ram would be more suitable. And this ram should be a virgin. The whole potential of its original total energy should not be diminished. For the highest spiritual working, one must accordingly choose that victim which contains the greatest and purest force. A male child of perfect innocence and high intelligence is the most satisfactory and suitable victim. What do you think Danny is? Young, virgin, male child, innocent, high intelligence, he can shine. That's the idea here. Fun fact, Dick Halloran gets axed inside of a circle, which is where the animal or kid should be killed, according to Crowley. But the point is that the blood is a spiritual offering, a medium to cross dimensions. And the reason for this entire ritual of crossing the abyss is to detach and destroy the ego, make contact with the divine or God. That's what is done through the usage of the number 42. And it's a purification process that is confronting the shadow, the darkness that resides within Jack. Only the shadow gets the better of Jack. And in the book version, there's an epigraph where Stephen King reads from Edgar Allan Poe's Mask of the Red Death, which Kubrick was using some aspects of this story as well. Like in Eyes Wide Shut, the orgy ringleader wearing the red cloak, which is in Mask of the Red Death. And there's a character named Ludovico, which ties into Clockwork Orange. Ludovico, you know, a character in Mask of Red Death. But the story has some ritual elements, blood sacrifices, satanic doctrines, and so on. And in Kubrick's... Okay, let me back up. So for the Making of Eyes Wide Shut book, as we talked about in the Eyes Wide Shut series, Kubrick picks up a book called Cult and the Occult by Peter Brooksmith. And he underlined a certain passage. I was able to buy that book, and this is the part where he talks about using children. This is from Cult and the Occult. It says, such a sacramental use of sexual intercourse can supposedly be employed as a means of acquiring occult power and at its highest lead to the ultimate goal of the mystic, union with the divine. The Emperor Barbarossa held young boys against his stomach and genitals to transfer their energy. So you can see why Danny would be the highest offering sacrifice, and that's why the house wants Jack to kill him so bad. And what's strange is in the book, Jack has a childhood memory of encountering this abstract painting of what he interpreted as Jesus. And the nun calls the painting the miracle of God. And the full context is that he's actually come to the realization that the hotel wants to get to Danny through Jack because Jack is weak. And he finds this out in chapter 33, no less, right? The highest number of Freemasonry, Christ's age during his death and resurrection, all that stuff. But this abstract painting, this miracle of God, Jack as a boy couldn't see it. He couldn't see Christ. He thought everyone else in the room, all the other students who said they could see it, he thought they were faking it. He's like, what are you talking about? I don't even see it. It's a metaphor for religion, I believe. But it's only when Jack gives up and casually sees it out of the corner of his eye that he has the realization and he sees the vision and he sees Christ. There's a big section here. It says, and he turned to go back and okay. And as he turned to go, he had seen the face of Jesus from the corner of his eye, sad and wise. He turned back, his heart in his throat. Everything had suddenly clicked into place, and he had stared at the picture with fearful wonder, unable to believe he had missed it. The eyes, the zigzag of shadow across the careworn brow, the fine nose, the compassionate lips. Look at Jackie Torrance. What had only been a meaningless sprawl had suddenly been transformed into a stark black and white etching of the face of Christ our Lord. Fearful wonder became terror. He had cussed in the front of a picture of Jesus. He would be damned. He would be in hell with the sinners. The face of Christ had been in the picture all along. Now, what's curious is that he has a similar moment in the shed when he's looking for the snowmobile battery. And he's looking for this battery for the snowmobile so they could take Danny down to the Sidewinder town. And he assumes someone just stole it when they packed up for the winter. And he's actually relieved because he didn't want to do it. He didn't want to take Danny down to the town. And it's when he goes to turn and leave, is when out of the corner of his eye, he finds the battery, right? Now, of course, he doesn't end up taking Danny down to the Sidewinder, but the point is there's a sort of weird idea of giving up and then seeing the truth, right? But the voices, so, and this is in the book, that's like kind of the metaphor for how this whole thing goes down, because Jack goes to put the battery in, but then there's some voices in his head, like they're like, hey, tear out the alternator, and he does, and he tosses it into the snow. So in conclusion, there's so much going on in The Shining, okay? It's kind of like a little mini Twin Peaks. And you can interpret so many angles that I believe this is why it makes it one of the greatest films of all time. People can tune into whatever resonates them, into what they see. And for me, I think the big one is this idea of demonic entities calling for the blood sacrifice of Jack's firstborn son. So in a way, it's a book about, or it's a story about religion and demonic forces overcoming us and taking over our bodies and possessing us. And even the dangers of communication with these entities is part of the process. And then, of course, you got all these sort of lighter topics that you see elements of, like MK Ultra, the mythology of the labyrinth and Saturn. You got the Baphomet stuff, and then you've got the real world stuff that was very interesting to me when you read the book, with the Key Club and Horace Derwin and these elitist parties that were going down with the masked balls and things like that, which makes me think even further about Eyes Wide Shut and how Kubrick made that a big scene, the orgy scene with the masked ball, which ties us into the same bloodlines that we're talking about in the book, right? They specifically call out the bloodlines in the book, which was interesting that Kubrick wouldn't put that in the movie. He just says all the finest people. So there you go. I hope you enjoyed that. That was a 3-part super deep dive. Sure was fun. But now I need you to stay subscribed to my show, because we're going to come back with a great deep dive into Fight Club, because I found some really interesting things in the book already. And I think that one's going to be a real banger of a show. So if you enjoy this show, you want to help it out, drop a 5-star review if you're on Apple or Spotify. If you're already on like Patreon or VIP section, no sweat. You're good. There's nowhere you can leave a 5-star. Appreciate it. If you're on the free feed, drop a 5-star, because that helps me out a ton. Because the problem is you got a lot of people out there who have teams of people behind them, and I'm a one-man army. So I need you to help me. Otherwise, we're going to lose to, you know, all these celebrities that decide they want to be podcasters too because they can't get enough attention. Well, I need your attention. So drop me a 5-star so other people can say, oh, look at this. This guy's doing good work. I appreciate that. All right? Okay. Thanks for your support. Till next time, stay positive.